Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, a very warm welcome in to Tech Talk, the blind and partially sighted community's opportunity to check in with the world of technology, whether that be accessible kit, advocacy, or something else. We'd love to know what's happening in your technology world. So do get in contact with the programme. It's your show. We always love to hear your voice. So you can send us a voice note or even just a good old-fashioned email. The email address, as always, it's techtalk, T-E-C-H-T-A-L-K, at rnib.org.uk. That's techtalk at rnib.org.uk. Coming up this week on Tech Talk, we'll be hearing from Steve Tyler, Director of Assistive Technology at Leonard Cheshire. Steve will be sharing his thoughts around so-called artificial intelligence. Callum Stoneman will be speaking with Stuart Lawler of Sight and Sound about the new HIMSS Sense Player, and we'll be catching up with some of your listener emails as well. Welcome in, as always, to our co-hosts, Tasdy Marchand, Callum Stoneman. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Hello, yeah, good, thanks. Good to be back for another week.
Indeedy. Tasneem, what's on your sort of technology planet at the moment?
Well, something that's been around for a while, actually, and I thought was no longer being produced anymore. But yeah, the UltraCane, I've kind of been reading around that on their website, and I'm quite intrigued and curious about it because there's a lot of mixed kind of, some people find it quite helpful, some people really don't like it because it's a little bit heavier than a normal cane. So I'm kind of exploring that a little bit and would really be interested in knowing what people's thoughts are on it.
And for anyone who hasn't encountered the UltraCane, just tell us very quickly, what does that do?
So it's a bit like a smart cane, I guess. It's battery operated, and instead of the normal cane, it's basically got some buttons in the handle. It vibrates, basically. You can set it to different kind of settings with, I don't know, obstacle detection at 2 meters or 4 meters. So I guess you can have an indoor and outdoor setting to your preference. And it kind of detects obstacles at chest and head height as well. So that's kind of what I like about it. And I'm quite intrigued to see how it all works.
So have you used a cane with a sort of a proximity sensor in there that vibrates, tells you when you're getting near to something that you perhaps don't want to get near to? Let us know. And there are lots of other kinds of devices. I guess the Sunu band and some of those technologies are doing a similar kind of thing, sort of giving you those haptic alerts to aid mobility. Callum Stoneman?
Yeah, do you know what? Many years ago, I used to use the eyeglasses from RNIB, but they just seemed to disappear. I thought they were fantastic. They were basically that sort of thing, but in a pair of sunglasses, and they had ultrasonic sensors on the frames. So if there was an obstacle at kind of face height, then the frames would vibrate. And I think they looked a bit weird. They were quite chunky, but I liked them. I thought they were a great product.
Wow, I've never heard of that, Callum. And it would be amazing if RNIB got those back on a more kind of updated version and make them less clunky. But yeah, that sounds really impressive.
Yeah, I mean, I have to confess, it has happened to me. I've been out and about and there might be something hanging low in front, you know, get a bramble in the face or something like that. And it can be quite uncomfortable. So let us know about your mobility tech. It would be really interesting to hear what helps you get out and about. Callum, what's happening in your world?
Well, I've just been reading about the new announcements from Sonos. So as you guys, or Sonos, however you want to say it, as you guys know, I'm a big audio fan, and they've just announced some new speakers. They've got the Era 100, which is like an upgraded version of the Sonos One speaker, which apparently just has better sound quality, better connectivity options. And then there's also, I think it's the Era 300, that's like a spatial audio speaker. And I'm just now trying to convince myself that I really don't need an upgrade to my Sonos system.
Yeah. So the other interesting thing about those products is the connectivity as well, because they've offered extra options for plugging in external devices, which was something that was only previously available on the 5 or the Kinect devices.
Yeah, they have. Yeah. So it's interesting stuff, and they're available for pre-order at the moment.
And spatial audio, Callum, I mean, do you think that's a kind of a marketing thing, or do you think it really is transformative in terms of listening to music and other audio?
I'm not sure. I I've tried it on a pair of AirPods. I don't honestly get the hype around it, to be completely honest. I think it depends what you're listening to. You know, if you're listening to some kind of soundscape or something that really benefits from moving around the room with you, you know, something that makes you feel like you're there, then I think it could be really good. But just for listening to a song, I'm not too sure.
So let us know, have you played with spatial audio? Do you get it? Do you think it's brilliant, amazing, or do you just think it's like a bit of marketing? So tell us your thoughts on spatial audio and mobility tech. We'd love to hear from you. techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Creating safe artificial general intelligence that benefits all humanity, that is the stated mission of the openai.com website. And one of the services garnering much attention in recent weeks and months is, of course, ChatGPT, a service of the OpenAI website, and it really aims to explore what artificial intelligence means. Well, to help us look at this from a disability perspective and in particular a blindness perspective, we're joined by Steve Tyler, who is the Director of Assistive Technology at Leonard Cheshire. Welcome back to RNIB Connect Radio, Steve.
Cheers, Dave. Hi, everyone.
So just let's jump straight in then. What do you understand by AI? How would you articulate what artificial intelligence is? Because it does seem to be a phrase that gets bandied about with some abandon, and it'd be good to know before we get into it, if we're going to use this term in this conversation, what we're referring to.
So if you put aside for the moment some of the hype and so on that a lot of the proponents of AI will talk to you about, the kind of stuff that you pick up in the media and so on, AI is a convenient short phrase, two words, artificial intelligence, which describes an area of computing which isn't really intelligent at all in the way we might normally think about it. And I'll try and just briefly explain that, because I think it is important that people kind of understand that. You know, when you and I and human beings and animals of every type, when we think of us or them as being intelligent, we tend to think in terms of a package of behaviors and senses and knowledge and memories and feelings that all come together to make this holistic sense of, quote, intelligence. So when you think about something, it's accompanied by hunches, it's accompanied by rational thought, it's accompanied by logic, it's accompanied by, but there's quite often an emotion attached to it. There might be a sensitivity about it. In thinking about any given thought, you're thinking about something else because it's triggered something else, or the conversation that you've just had triggers something in somebody else. Now, that is very tricky. People have tried to measure intelligence. You know, everybody knows about IQ ratings and intelligent quotient and all of these kinds of things. And then people now talk about emotional intelligence and things like that. So we've struggled with this for a long time, the understanding what is intelligence. If you just park that where computing is concerned, if you think about what's going on in computers, regardless of anything else, forget emotions, forget anything else, it's zeros and ones. These are binary machines which operate based on primarily logic, but anyway, they have software running in them one way or the other. And the whole business is electronics, which operates in a binary way. And what we've managed to do is develop algorithms or groupings of calculations, and we've got very high-speed products now that make thousands, millions of calculations per second. And because of that, they begin to feel quite intelligent. They do and even say or show things because you've triggered them in some way to do that, and you can make them feel and look very intelligent. In an effort to try to bring some sense to the discussion around machine intelligence, there is a test called the Turing test. And the test basically is, if I'm sitting in front of a screen and I don't know, you know, I've got two things responding to me. I can type onto a keyboard, but I can type whatever I want. One of them is a machine that I'm typing into, and one of them is to you, Dave. And I don't know which one is which. And the Turing test says, how long does it take before I realize that one of them is the human being and one of them is the machine? And that is a way of getting a sense of, well, where are we on this scale of so-called intelligent machinery? How far have we got where we can actually fool people into thinking, blimey, yeah, this is genuinely intelligent. I actually can't tell the difference now between, is this a person or is this a machine? And that's something that is still one of the tests we do today as a way of trying to measure, you know, how convincing we are, or how convincing computers are.
There's a lot to think about there, obviously. Philosophy, politics, technology, all sorts of issues arise from that. And it feels as though we have arrived at a point where a machine can put up a pretty convincing performance now to almost simulate or create the illusion that you might be having a dialogue with another person. Yeah, and we'll talk about your experience because you've been playing with this. And I guess the really interesting question now is, how useful is that test? Because actually, even if you can make a machine or a service that appears to demonstrate some elements of you know, what you might think of as behavior or even free will or even ethics or whatever, that doesn't necessarily make that machine intelligent. And I think that's a really important distinction that you've drawn out there. What we think of as human intelligence and what we think of as machine intelligence are still actually quite different things.
They are, but it has now become horribly confusing, and I'll give you a sense of why I think that. So as you mentioned earlier, to get on to ChatGPT, you have to sign up. It's free to sign up at the moment, although there is a paid for service. So you sign up at openai.com and you give it it's a box standard thing. You give it an account and make up a password, and there you go, you're in. And it gives you access to the chat thing. Now you have to sign, or you have to agree to a set of statements largely saying, look, this is still in research mode, and you're promising not to use this for anything other than, and you're recognizing that this is a research piece. So it's not, you know, we don't want you to take this too seriously.
So you've gone on there with your screen reader, and you found the sign-up process to be straightforward and accessible. You don't need to provide any financial details. You just need a working email address. So you're doing that on your computer or your phone, Steve?
I signed up on my computer, but I've also been onto the service with my phone, having created a login thing. So, and both are okay.
The interface essentially is like that of a chatbot. So you might have encountered these things on technical support websites, shopping websites, where you have an edit box, you type in your question, and then somebody or something attempts to provide you with a reply.
That's right. So basically you end up, there's lots of blurb, which you've got to get past. But if you look for the edit box, that's where the action is happening, or at least, you know, it's expecting you to put something in there.
So what sorts of things have you asked it then, Steve?
To begin with, I asked it things that I really did want to know, or things that would test out what it was like. So I've said things like, what's a good place to take children who are 11 and 14 years old on holiday in Europe? And it will come back with, yeah, here are five places it could be good to visit, and it lists them and tells you what you might see there. So it talks about Italy, and it tells you nice places in Italy and some of the coastal resorts there.
Right, but you could ask, you could put that into TripAdvisor or any number of websites, right?
But the difference is you're not needing to look at websites. There are no links. There are no, it's like talking to someone. Tell me some good places to visit. Oh yeah, here you go. Here's some good places to visit. Immediately after it's given you that initial, you can say, oh, but what about if I'm traveling in August? So then you discover it's context aware. So it knows what the conversation is. You'd have to keep reminding it or keep restating the question. You can just keep going as if you're in a dialogue with somebody. What about August? Oh, I like the idea that you've just told me about in Greece, but what other places in Greece might there be that you would recommend? And if you plow on down that route, it will give you more and more detail. Or you can say, well, you mentioned Athens in August, but that's a terrible place. Gets really hot in August, doesn't it? You can say things like that. And it will give you a very convincing human response. It might say, you're not wrong about that. Yes, it does get very hot in August. Actually, the temperature last year reached whatever it reached. Yes, thinking about it, might not be a great idea to take children there in August. It might say something like that. But one way or another, it tends to be quite unique what it says.
And you can specify the style in which you want the answer. So if you want the answer presented as a letter or a blog post or an essay or a poem or a story in the style of a particular writer or author, you can add that to your request.
So I've been down the route of saying, can you write me 1,000 words on the importance of accessibility to blind people in the United Kingdom? And it will write a very convincing 1,000 words on exactly that subject. And it gives you chapter and verse. It refers to legislation. It refers to what we mean by accessibility. It tells you the kind of things that are out there that enable accessibility. Then you can say, oh, right. Yeah, the audience for this is quite technical. So can you do that again? But give it to me as a more technical piece. Oh, and by the way, I'm more interested in the web area rather than anything else. So can you focus on that? Now it will come back with exactly the same kind of thing, but this time it's going to give you examples for, you know, it might give you examples of how you make something accessible on a website rather than not.
Let's just sort of back up the truck a little bit, though. So what we're getting here is what appears to be, you know, a well thought out, well reasoned case for accessibility in the terms of the legal framework, the financial incentives, the moral imperative, all of that, right? But that suggests a kind of a deeper level of understanding and intelligence, which you'd have to question, is that really the case, or is it trotting out phrases that it's found in literature and kind of stitching those together in a way that would kind of pattern match that sort of rhetoric?
So the intelligence, in inverted commas, sits in the algorithms or rules that govern the way it constructs language. That's the cleverness of it. So it's looking through the net, through a whole host of different places. It's effectively doing searches, but it's bringing that information together And it cleverly is able to construct sentences and phrases and paragraphs and pages that look and feel very human, because it knows a thing or two about how language is constructed. And so it's using language modeling systems to help it appear to be giving you a very, very comprehensive piece of information. And it's also remembering things. So when I sort of challenged it and said, yes, but can you give me some more examples? Yes, sure, I can give you some examples. It knows that's how people talk. And then it's still, it's in the background, it's doing its searches and it's trying to find numeric examples now, because it knows that's what I want. I want something to do with numbers and finances and business, and it's turning that into something that feels half acceptable. That's what it's doing. That's what gives it the veneer of being intelligent.
Right. And also, to add to that, I mentioned earlier about being able to specify a writing style or almost like a creative style. So you might use a particular, you might reference a particular author or artist. So you get this kind of illusion of creativity. And that can evoke an emotional response from the unsuspecting reader, and you've had that.
I asked it to write me a poem in the style of Chaucer for Mother's Day, but I gave it some additional information. I said, my wife's name is Sean, we've got two boys, here are their names, this is how old they are. By the way, it might be of interest to know that Sean's interests include materials, design, stained glass. I gave it a number of other hints about her. It came back with three or four verses of poem that were absolutely bang on in the style of Chaucer, and it was unique. To your point, it's very, very clever at language. What it was doing was imposing some additional rules governing how it parses or how it interprets and then puts together language. And I said, Chaucer, that's what I want. Now, the emotional response was in me. It wasn't in it. It just delivered the thing. My response was, wow. When you experience it, you think, goodness me. Yeah, all very interesting. A bit like Steve Tyler dissing this whole intelligence thing, or sort of saying, ah, yeah, but it's not really intelligent. This is all about, but blimey.
So we have to temper our enthusiasm. And I had a similar experience. I asked it to explain the offside rule to children in the style of Stephen Fry. And it started out by saying something like, now, dear children, imagine, if you will, a grand game of football played out on luscious green turf, you know. And so it was very flowery, you know, language. And when I first read that, I was really taken with the, oh, this is just like Stephen Fry. I wonder if he ever actually wrote this, you know, somewhere. And actually, our response to it really is perhaps should be considered in the same way that you might first react the first time you ever use a calculator to compute something really complex, because that's essentially what it's doing.
Essentially what it's doing. But because it's so honed in to understanding language, which is a deeply, deeply human-oriented thing, and that language and the way we talk to each other and think about each other and respond to each other, a lot of it is kind of, you know, language is a core part of that, or writing and communicating. This is right in that place that so far we think is very special. It's one of those things that we say as humans sets us apart. That's what we like to believe, at least. And all of a sudden, got these machines now that seem to be able to convincingly do linguistic things to you, to the point where those poems can be very emotive. those poems can make you cry.
But our wonder is akin to that of the horseless carriage or the box in the corner of the room that can show you a picture of somebody talking from the other side of the world, that actually this isn't intelligence in the way you initially described it, in that human way, emotional intelligence. It is the clever manipulation of language.
The best way I can describe it, and for some of the audience this may seem slightly odd as well, but bear with me for a minute. I'm in my work at the moment, I'm doing work on what would at first seem really, you know, well, it is bleeding edge, you know, technology. So this is brainwave analysis. Quite simple, though, at the moment. I say simple in quotes. But, you know, we can analyze brainwave patterns that enable people to use a switch. Switch it on, switch it off. Turn it up, turn it down. Make it left, make it right. That's quite powerful, because if you can make things go up or down or off and on or left and right, you know, actually, you've got quite a bit of control. You can turn the thermostat up by thinking about it, in quotes. Or you can, you know, turn the lights off. You can switch the camera on. You can turn the telly over. Now, what's actually happening is we're making it look very impressive, and it does look very impressive, because on the face of it, what's going on is, you know, someone is sitting there thinking a thought, and because of that thought, something happens. Now, it is really clever. It is, no doubt about it. You know, there's a really big advance, but it's not as clever as you think, because what's actually happening is we've managed to find patterns, or at least, so when I think, make it go up, make it go down, when I think those thoughts, the patterns that come off my head are the same each time, or similar. And so when you get a machine that monitors that and says, ah, right, he's thinking up, that's what he wants, that's what's going on. To the onlooker, though, it's really impressive. Really impressive. It's something like that going on in GPT chat.
So, Steve, this is fascinating. I just want to ask you one really quick final question, as succinctly as you can. What ways do you think this technology might help us tackle digital accessibility problems?
It can write code. So, in principle, it can look at a website and say, I know how to fix this. So, it's a good start of a 10. It can look at an app and say, I think you could enhance accessibility by doing X, Y, and Z. Here's some code for you to do it. But accessibility in a broader sense is already being used, or versions of it are being used. So, for example, so just been talking about how clever it is in language terms and so on. It's very good, as it turns out, at supporting people who are, for example, lonely. So there are a couple of apps already out there where this is being tested now, where, you know, this back-end intelligence, you know, it develops a persona, but more to the point, it gets to know what you're like. And it gives you very convincing responses. So you can log in and talk to it or write to it. And it's like a friend at the end of the phone, with the added value that if it's sensing, for example, that you're hitting deeper depression, say, it might advise you, or it might say, oh, you know, there are ways I could help you with that, or perhaps you want to talk to somebody. So there are genuinely fascinating and new ways in which it can help. And finally, because of the nature of it, because the big effort has been put into language understanding, representing information. So if you put aside the concerns we expressed just earlier on, how true is it? how sure can you be? But representing information in ways that normal people can understand, you don't have to be a computer geek, don't have to be proficient at the web, don't have to, you know, as long as we put the checks and balances in place so that what you're getting is genuinely kosher, robust, trustable information, it becomes a very new and interesting way of interfacing with masses and masses of information.
Steve Tyler, Director of Assistive Technology at Leonard Cheshire. Thanks very much.
Cheers.
Steve Tyler there from Leonard Cheshire sharing his thoughts about so-called AI. And let's just stick with AI. I appreciate there is some debate about the terminology, machine learning, language models, but we're just, for convenience, going to call it AI. Callum Stoneman, you've been playing with the Bing implementation. Do you think this is something that is going to be genuinely useful or just a bit of a fad?
I think ChatGPT was a bit on the techie side. You know, you had to go out of your way to find it. You had to, you know, go online and you had to sign up and you had to kind of know what it was about. You didn't have to be a, you know, computer geek to use it, but you did have to kind of know what you were doing, what you were looking for. I think this new implementation with Bing, it's no secret that pretty much everyone uses Google, really, don't they? But I think Microsoft have put up a real rival here with this Bing. And, you know, I haven't used some of the gimmicky stuff. I haven't got it to, you know, write me a poem or write me a story. But I have used it for finding information. So like I said at the start of the show that about the Sonos announcement that I've been reading up on, and I didn't actually go Googling and looking for it. I'd heard something about Sonos making an announcement of new speakers. So I just said to Microsoft's Bing, can you tell me about the new Sonos speakers that have recently been announced? And it just came back with all this information about the new announcements, and they'd only been announced the day before. But the difference is, because ChatGPT was last trained in 2021, it's just got a huge pool of data, but ends at 2021. So it doesn't know about things that happened yesterday. It doesn't know about, for example, the cost of living crisis that we've got going on, or the things like the situation in Ukraine. It has no idea about that. But Bing is constantly being kept up to date, so you can just ask it anything and it pulls the information back. And that just meant that it does provide references, it does provide links to where it's getting its information from, which is another thing that ChatGPT doesn't do. But like for the Sonos example, I could go and check the links that it gave me if I wanted to, but I didn't have to go trolling through articles and skipping past all the ads, and, you know, I could just type in my question and get an answer. So it's fantastic as a search engine.
So what's the difference between that and, say, Google in the early days before you know, things got a little bit busier with the advertising?
You know, Google will provide you a list of links, essentially, you know, to things that it thinks are relevant. And most of the time it's correct. But nowadays with this, it's just giving you an answer in a nice, plain text format with the option of the additional info if you want to go and look at it.
Tasneem Arshad, you work in healthcare, and we heard in the interview with Steve Tyler about how AI could be used to combat loneliness and isolation and perhaps offer psychological support. Do you think there is a role there for AI, or do you think we've got to proceed with caution?
Well, absolutely proceed with caution. So I think it's a great additional tool. So, for example, if you're really struggling with your mental health and you want to be signposted and you need more information, you want to read up around it, what support and services are available locally to you, absolutely brilliant tool to go in there. You don't want to be searching. You maybe want to do a voice command and ask it, or you just want to type in, you know, some basics, and it can give you some information and give you hopefully some relevant and accurate information, as it did with Callum. But as I said, if it depends on what you're using. If you're going to use the one that's just got the information from 2021, it's still going to hold some relevant information, because, you know, things like Samaritans and various other services, their numbers generally don't change. So it's fairly good in that respect, I think. And also, I know that some trusts adopt this artificial chat box. You know, we're currently looking at it in our trust, and it's going to be taking referrals. So it's going to be just, you know, you ring up, It asks a load of questions, takes all of your details down, and it gets you into our system, and then it just shuts down. So there's no way of sort of tracking or monitoring your referral as such, but it gets you into our healthcare system more quickly than humans kind of answering the phone and taking all those details down. So it's kind of like a fast track, I guess, in that respect. And then as therapists, we will have all of that information. So I think there is a role for it, but it's certainly not a instead of human support or psychological or medical interventions.
Sure. What about companionship, though? I've heard from older people that actually, once they get to grips with it, they quite like talking to their smart speaker. Could AI offer some level of companionship for somebody who is lonely, or is there a risk that might inhibit natural human relationships?
Maybe there is a little bit of a role, but I think you've just got to be careful in that. Again, it's not a substitute for humans, is it? It's kind of just, I guess, if you were caring for somebody who had a particular health condition and they were, you needed some respite time for an hour or two, something like that, short term, where they can have a chat with Lady A or with artificial intelligence, potentially there's a role for that, as in keeping somebody company for an hour or two, half an hour, something like that, whilst, the carer or whoever goes out and has that respite time, maybe something like that would could potentially work. But I'm kind of thinking of the disadvantages, when you've got children who are ordering things offline and they accidentally, do something in that respect, how is the AI going to respond to that? And are there security measures in place? Again, for students writing dissertations and essays, if you ask it a question and ask and say, can you give me 1,000 words on whatever critical analysis you're doing, then, that would be quite concerning if it's just going to come back with all of the answers and all the references for you.
Safeguarding is definitely an area of interest, and we will certainly watch this carefully. Callum, you've mentioned the Bing example, and of course Microsoft looking at ways in which AI might be used across productivity tools. So actually this to me sounds like a great thing, because if I've got to write a report, it's the actual writing of it that I really, will do almost anything to avoid. Like, I know what I want to say and I know the key information needs to be included, but just the idea of sitting down and writing all that stuff, if I could just tell the machine, write me a report making, these 6 points and these were my kind of findings and conclusions, that'd be great, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And they're thinking of tying this into all of their products. So as you said, Word, Excel, I think they're on about tying it into Outlook as well. I don't know if that's available in the beta yet, but I know that's something they want to do. So even being able to say, for example, and this doesn't just benefit blind people, this could benefit people with dyslexia and, people who just struggle to maybe read and write. You could, write an email and then just say to the chatbot, can you proofread this email, or can you make this email a bit more formal or a bit less formal? And it will just help you out in that sense and, potentially just make your life a bit more productive. That's one use that I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, if any chatbot would like to reply to all my email, I'd be very grateful indeed. Yeah. Tasneem Arshad, Callum Stoneman, I'm sure we're going to be talking about this lots more as we go through the year in future programmes. Let us know your thoughts. Have you had a bit of a play with ChatGPT or the new Bing or some other implementation of artificial intelligence? Let us know. techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Maybe you'll get a chatbot to write the email for you.
HIMSS are a well-known assistive technology company. They manufacture several products, probably the most notable being the Braille Sense line of note takers. And the latest product from them is the Sense Player. And joining me now to tell us a bit more about this is Stuart Lawler from Sight and Sound Technology. Hey Stuart, welcome to Tech Talk.
Hi Callum, great to be here on Tech Talk, great to chat to you. I'm a big fan, by the way, love the show.
Ah, thanks, appreciate it. So I'm sure people who've been involved with the Sight and Sound webinars during lockdown will probably know your name and your voice. But for those who don't know you, just tell us a bit about you and your role at Sight and Sound to start off with.
Sure, Callum. So as you said, I'm Stuart Lawler. I'm head of the digital content end of sight and sound technology, I suppose, which means I'm responsible for a lot of our online outputs in the UK and here in Ireland. And the second hat I wear, I suppose, in Ireland is I manage the Irish arm of sight and sound technology we set up here in 2018. So I've I've kind of two roles that operate here and in the UK. And of course, as you said, during the pandemic, we were doing a lot of webinars, and we still are, I suppose, and we have our podcast, and we have a lot of active things going on our website. So it's a really interesting role, very exciting things going on, and it's an exciting industry, I suppose, to be involved in.
It is, especially at the minute. It feels like the specialist tech is kind of coming back in a way.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, as we record, we're about a week out from CSUN, and I'm sure you guys will be talking more about CSUN on the show. But it's going to be interesting to see what announcements come out of that, especially for me anyway. I'm watching this world of multi-line braille devices. I think we're going to see some more of that very soon.
Yeah, I'm watching that keenly as well. I can't wait for more on that. So tell us a bit about this Sense Player then. So what actually is this, and, you know, what are the new features of it?
So the Sense Player is a portable media device. You know, we're all carrying mobile phones around with us now, whether it's iPhone or Android, or maybe it's a specialist phone, or maybe you have the more traditional Nokia phones. But lots of us are using our phones for lots of things. And I suppose one of the challenges with that is you find that maybe the battery doesn't last you the full day, and when you need your phone, the battery is gone, or you're carrying a power bank, or you're having to find a charging port. So the Sense Player is, as I said, a portable media device, allowing you to read books, listen to music, access podcasts. And because it's an Android tablet, if you like, the possibilities for expanding the device are really interesting. So we're just seeing the start of what the device has to offer at the moment. And we can talk about some more of those features in detail if you want. But, you know, in the future, we're going to have access to Android apps, or at least some Android apps. So, for example, Audible content, or access to Spotify with a mobile screen reader. So a lot of things coming down the pipeline for this device, and it's just starting.
So is that kind of the big development then, the fact that because this is on Android, rather than it being, because traditionally with these devices, it's kind of been, you buy these, it's got these features, and that's kind of it. You might get one or two software updates that add something or change something, but really what you buy is kind of what you're stuck with. And I guess that's the real difference with this, that it's based on Android, and as you said, the being able to expand it is kind of endless, really, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And HIMSS have big plans to do that. Anyone who has the Braille Sense device already, the Braille Sense 6, and even the older Braille Sense Polaris, you'll know that the updates for that were quite frequent. And there was lots of stuff added even in the last year and a half. So we're going to see a lot of that ported onto the Sense Player. Some of it's there already, like access to podcasts, access to Bookshare, and some of the sort of look and feel or the user interface that you'll come to know and love from the Braille Sense is very much there, like the file manager, the document reader, the Daisy reader. That's all present on this tiny Sense Player device.
So can you give any kind of physical description of this? You know, how tiny are we talking?
So it feels a little bit like, or about the same size as an iPhone 3GS, or if you have one of the, I have an iPhone mini, I think it's a iPhone 12 mini. It's not unlike that in size. It has a number pad on the bottom half of the device, I suppose. And then directly above the number pad, you have a series of controls comprising a set of cursor keys, left, right, up and down, with a select button in the middle. And just above that, you have a set of four keys to turn Bluetooth and Wi-Fi on and off, to cycle through different modes when you're using the device. And the final key, and I suppose, Callum, one of the features that makes this device rather unique is the option to use something called Smart Connect. And Smart Connect uses Bluetooth technology to connect to a device, another device that you have. It could be a phone, it could be a tablet. So it could be a touchscreen, something with a touchscreen, to allow you to control it using the Sense Player. And you can even route the speech from the device you're connecting to through the Sense Player. So you could control your iPhone, for example, using the Sense Player.
As well as having its own controls, it can connect to, for example, your iPhone and control that as well.
It can, yeah. So there's a key map for iPhone and there is an Android key map. So, for example, if you wanted to send a text message or a WhatsApp message without having to take your phone out of your pocket, you could use your Sense Player, use Smart Connect to connect to your phone. And then you would use the old traditional T9 method of sending texts, Callum, if you have memories of that in the dim and distant past. So that's what you would do in that case. So the Smart Connect feature is really interesting because in the future, you will be able to record the Smart Connect audio as well. So this could be interesting if you wanted to maybe capture the recording of something from your phone, if you wanted to maybe make a recording of a phone conversation. There's lots of options there. And of course, the Sense Player, when it's standalone, has a recording facility as well. It has the option to connect USB microphones or mixers or any other type of audio device that you want. And it also, I should have said this earlier, the Sense Player, there will be two models. The Sense Player has a camera. So you can buy the device with a camera or without a camera. And if you opt to get the camera, you can recognize text on pages. And you can also recognize text from an image file that you might load onto the device. A little bit like the Blaze, except the Blaze didn't have the option to recognize an image file.
Well, that's something that I was going to come on to, actually, the Blaze. So what's the difference? Because to be honest, I'll be completely honest, until we started doing this, I'd never heard of the Blaze. So what are the differences between that and this?
Well, I guess the fact that we're on Android, as we mentioned earlier, there's going to be a lot more. The Blaze was exactly as you say. It was kind of, it was a product that came out, a really good product at the time. Bear in mind, it's 8-9 years since the first Blaze came out. Had its camera. And the big thing of the Blaze was scanning and reading books. You know, it was a book player and scanning. It didn't have any way to have any apps, very basic file management, but couldn't really share content with, for example, a Braille Sense or anything else. Didn't have podcast facilities. You've got all this on the Sense Player.
Nice. So it sounds like a worthy upgrade then.
I think it is. I think there are people who definitely like these devices. There are people who like buttons, who like devices with physical tactile controls, but there are also people who like to be able to listen to their content without getting calls coming in or other interruptions coming from their mobile device. And if that's you, and if you've had these mobile players before, it's going to be certainly worth checking it out.
And just coming back to the Smart Connect, you mentioned that you can route the audio of your iPhone or your Android phone to the Sense Player. Does that extend to phone calls as well? So yes. Could you essentially have your phone in another room and use this to answer a phone call?
So I think it will. At the moment, you can route the output. I think the next step is routing the input. So exactly as you say, using the built-in microphone on the Sense Player to send your voice back through Smart Connect to the iPhone or the Android phone.
That is really interesting. It makes it more than just a portable player in that sense, doesn't it? Pun intended, sense.
yeah. Well, absolutely. I suppose in an instance where you have one device, maybe you're on a busy train or something, and your phone's in your bag or your phone's in your pocket, you don't have to try to manage two devices. You can just tap Smart Connect, and it will connect. Bring you into a list of the recent connections you have. So you could have more than one connection. Obviously, you might have your iPhone, you might have your iPad, you might have an Android tablet. Scroll to whichever of those you wish to connect to, press select, and you're connected.
And then the OCR feature. So these are two different models, is that right? You can buy one without OCR.
Yeah, exactly. One with and one without.
And the one with the OCR, how much are we talking with that? Is it just a simple, you know, just for short bits of text, or could you scan a whole document or a whole book with it if you wanted to?
So what I have seen of it, and I have only scanned a page, and we've been beta testing this for a little while, and the OCR has definitely been a work in progress in terms of just getting that right. So certainly in the early days of beta testing, you were getting far better results and far more quickly with something like Seeing AI. That's improved now. Scanning a page, you can obviously then read that file and you can save that file and, you know, potentially share it with something else or send it somewhere else, put it onto a memory card, put it onto your computer or to your note taker. Similarly, with the image files, you can load them onto the device or have them on a memory card, and you can scan them that way.
And is this doing, when it does its scans, is this doing it locally on the device? So it doesn't require an internet connection?
It doesn't require an internet connection. It does have an internet connection for things like podcasts, to download books. It has a web radio. It also has a good old traditional radio, by the way. So local stations on the FM band that you want to listen to, you can hear. But yeah, it doesn't use the internet for scanning.
Okay. And in terms of price, do we have an idea of price on for these?
Yes, we do. So the Sense Player OCR, which is the one with the camera, is £645. And the Sense Player without OCR is £475. And there is also, if you wish, a stand you can buy that you can slot the Sense Player into for making the camera, I suppose, a little more steady. And then you can put your text underneath. And that stand, if you want it, is £45.
Okay. And if people are interested in getting their hands on this, getting more information, or are you offering demonstrations of this as well?
Absolutely. So our sales team, our field sales team, are all over the country at the moment. I do believe they've been showing this a bit. It's worth saying that the device is not going to ship until the end of March. And that's because we're waiting for another software update that's going to make life a little bit easier in terms of Smart Connect. So it's not going to ship yet, but we are actively showing it. And if you wish to order, you can get in touch with the office. And there's also information on sightandsound.co.uk on the website.
Fantastic. Stuart Lawler from Sight and Sound, thanks for joining us.
Callum, it's a pleasure. Take care.
We've heard from David Weston, who is interested to learn more about the Emporia tablet. And David wanted to just double check, what's the address for Emporia's website? Well, we can tell you, David, it is emporiamobile.com. That's emporiamobile.com. That's emporiamobile.com. And stay tuned, because in a future episode, we are hoping to bring you a demonstration of that very same Emporia tablet. And also, we've had an email from Rod Kahn, and Rod picks up on the conversation we were having a couple of weeks ago about moving your smart speakers into a new room. And I was saying that I'd found it difficult to get the name of the room to stick. And Rod says that he has found that actually what you need to do is change the name in the Apple Home app before you change it on the Alexa. And he thinks that should improve things, and also rename the device to the name of the room, just to avoid any ambiguity. So if you've got any tips about relocating your smart home devices, do's and don'ts, we'd love to hear them. What works, what doesn't work, always good to hear from you. Thanks there, Rod. I'll give that a go and let you know how I get on. We come to the end of another Tech Talk. Thank you so much for your company. It's always good to have you listening. And if you have any thoughts about anything you've heard on the programme, we're always open to that. You can send us a voice note or an email to techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Be sure to tune in next time when I'll be reporting from the California State Conference on Technology and Disability. Tasneem Arshad, Callum Stoneman, thank you very much.
Thank you, and see you soon.
Thank you. Bye for now.
And from me, Dave Williams, and the rest of the team, bye-bye.